Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Now you're welcome back. You might recognise our next guest from her TikTok and Instagram and everywhere online, because Nadia Adan has spent some years selling cars now and building a big following online, and finally launching her own car showroom earlier this year. And her life wasn't always luxury cars and fancy things. It was a tough journey out of Somalia to the world of stock trading. Good Lord, thank God you got out of there. You've lived quite a life, Nadia Adan. Welcome and good morning.
Hello, Oliver. Thank you for having me on.
Your arrival in studio is everything I dreamed of.
Oh, I know. I brought it for you. I'm hoping you...
very classy. Very classy entrance. Now, we're going to come to Ashford Motors. That's your baby now, isn't it? That's
yes.
You're the first female showroom owner.
Yeah, I believe I'm the first female showroom independent dealer, because there's obviously a lot of main dealers that have females in it and stuff like that. But also the difference is that I don't have a motor trade family background, and that's a big difference.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, a lot of generations would have started with having maybe the parents in the business, and I don't have any of that, you know. So that's
no
just,
Nepo motorhead.
No, exactly. I have been called nepotism, but I tell you, when you've come from Mogadishu, there's no nepotism here.
No one's accusing you of that. Oh yeah, the Mogadishu circle, golden circle.
Absolutely.
So we will come back to Ashford Motors, but your story is so unreal. It's incredible. So you come to Ireland, what are you, three, four years of age when you come here?
Yes, exactly. So I'm 34, and the Somalian war started in the early 90s, and we fled just after. And I suppose, as you were saying, everybody remembers that horrific war. It's still ongoing. There are nearly 4 million Somalians displaced all over the world. And even now, there's people been living there in refugee camps for 30 years that were born there, that still live in refugee camps. So this has just been a horrific war. Before that, I came from a very good life. It was me and my mum. My mum actually had her own airline business, and she used to work with the UN to ship medical supplies into Mogadishu. And then when the war broke out, the airspace got shut down. We lost everything. She lost family, and it was just the two of us.
Society literally collapsed there.
Literally.
You had a nice middle class existence, and then it's just...
And it's just gone. And of course, especially in Africa, if you don't have anything, there's no help. You can't start from anything. You're literally on the street. Mm. So a lot of people were getting out, and that was the first thought on my mum's mind, was we need to get out.
So getting out meant coming to a refugee camp in Ethiopia?
Yeah, so exactly. So we started the journey. We got contact, like at the time, everybody was getting contacted by traffickers. If you had a few quid, you were just trying to get out. And we went through all the eastern countries. So Ethiopia, Sudan. We actually ended up in Sudan. We were in a refugee camp there for...
How does the travel happen, does your mum tell you?
By bus, by walking. And then when we left Africa, it was by boat. So by the time we got through Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya. We ended up in Libya. We were in jail in Libya for about 6 months.
This, so by the way, is still the case for refugees moving across Africa. They end up in Libya trying to get to Europe.
Correct.
And they're imprisoned there because
exactly.
the gangs run Libya, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time, they really didn't... The Somalians were just ostracised, you know. Right. It was a really tough time. So if you can imagine, it was my mum and me, a young child. A lot of parents would have left their child, tried to go get a better life, and then bring them with them then. And she just couldn't leave me, you know. I kind of wish she did sometimes. As in, like, you know, the stress that she had gone through to do all that, you know.
Yeah.
But again, I was quite young, and I felt the protection of her all the time. And, you know, I don't know how she did it, to be honest with you.
You have no memory of that.
I have certain memories.
Because it's such a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I remember one particular night, we were walking through like a field. It was in the middle of the night. There was 30 or 40 of us. And again, I have a lot of memories that my mum has talked about as well. Mm. And it was just me and her with all these people, and we got to a shack and we all slept on the ground, but they gave the bed to me and my mum. And just little things like that I kind of remember, and then her speaking about it. But yeah, no, I don't have a great memory of it.
That's like a moment of kindness among the other refugees, isn't it? That there was only one bed, and they said the mammy and
child. Give it to
the
mammy and child.
So it's kind of random that Ireland is chosen in the end, is it?
We didn't even know Ireland existed. We just thought we were going to get to an English-speaking country because she had English. She wanted me to get an education, and she just fought with all her will all her will and might, and we ended up in Italy and then in Ireland, and we ended up in O'Connell Street, believe it or not.
Literally, yeah, wandering O'Connell Street.
Literally wandering O'Connell Street.
Not knowing where you are.
Not knowing where we were. And because we came from a good life, we were dressed well, so we didn't look like your particular, you know, homeless kind of people. And Mam had a lovely mink coat on, and I was standing there, and the Irish people welcomed us so much. They were so kind. I even remember somebody gave her £100 note, she told me, and it was £100 note back then. It was pounds, you know.
This is in the '90s.
This is in the '90s. They were so kind, but back then there wasn't that many refugees coming in, so it wasn't something you were used to seeing, I suppose.
Yeah. And there was no Somali community at all.
Very little. I think, God, if maybe one other. If I could say my mum maybe is the first Somali to ever land in Ireland, I'd be betting on that.
Certainly in a mink coat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Literally a mink coat?
Literally a mink coat, yeah. That's I actually have it in one of my viral videos and that went viral, so there you go.
I'm trying to think of the use of a mink coat in Somalia.
Yeah, you can't.
By cold winters?
Well, she was, when she had her airline business, she used to go to Moscow she leased Antonovs and Cessnas, so she was able to get a nice mink coat over there. She's a great businesswoman, to be fair to her.
Her story. So she comes to Ireland with almost nothing?
Almost nothing except this mink coat. I'm surprised she didn't pawn it off.
Amazing. Yeah, that is amazing.
And we went to the Justice Department. We asked for asylum. And back then, it wasn't really like it is now. The process was really quick. We were put into what was called direct provision. 6 months later, Mam had her papers. She could go out and work, which is what she did.
Extraordinary. So the asylum is granted really quickly in those days. You're not languishing for years.
Exactly. And that's the difference, is that there's a decision. You know, you're not sitting somewhere idle for years and years and years.
So the numbers were very small.
Numbers were very small, exactly. And so she could get out work, and she took whatever job she could get. She was packing boxes in a factory. She was working in the back of the pub. And then all I heard was education. So she really, really pushed me through school and all of that. And yeah, she worked every day.
Did you feel different in school?
Did I feel different in school? Not really. I think I've been through so many different situations. I've been very good at just fitting in, especially, you know, with the accent and everything like that, you know, and I was able to get the Dublin accent after a few years. I struggled, I think, academically, because there was a couple of years of, you know, that kind of gap, you know. So, and Mum, I don't think she understood that, like, she was out working so much. I was on my own a lot. And I think she just thought I'd get that discipline out of nowhere. And you don't. You have to really be with kids and help them through their homework. But you don't realise that back then. And then there was the culture difference between my mum and me. I was growing up in Fir House she was Somalian. And, you know, that was really tough. But we navigated through that now.
Was that a language? What language you have spoken at home?
Yeah, so English. Together? English. I've always... English is my English is perfect. Exactly. Her English is perfect. So it was always English. So I do speak Somali, but and we speak a little bit of it. But I English was the first language. So
what were the cultural kind of
differences?
Mother daughter tensions at home.
I used to run around, go to the fields, go drink, and I was a terrible kid. And she
a normal Dublin kid.
Exactly, yeah. A normal Dublin kid. But that wasn't normal for my mum, and she would come out and drag me in each time. And I thought she was ruining my life, but when I look back now, I'm glad she did it, because I could have gone down the wrong way. And she just, her having a business but maybe not having that education background meant she had to start again from nothing. She didn't want that for me. She wanted me to have an education, so I always had something to fall back on.
And she worked every job she could get.
She had two or three jobs. I never saw her. She used to drop me off at the neighbour's house at 5 a.m. She'd walk to Walkinstown from Fir House. She'd pack boxes all day. I'd be at the after school till maybe 6. She'd be late nearly every day. And it's not that she didn't love me. She loved me so much.
Of course,
she
was working.
Yeah, she was working, yeah. And we were in rent. We were private rental accommodation. We didn't have government assistance initially to cover the cost to get us up and running and into private rental accommodation. And yeah, so went through my primary school, then went on to secondary school, struggled a little bit. Again, anytime I was out of line, she kind of slapped me back, you know, back into line very quickly.
And it was all that to do with education.
It was, yeah. And again, throughout my degree, which I did in financial services and investment analysis, I wouldn't have been straight A's. I would have gotten through the exams, but I was always struggling. I'd always have to repeat exams. She would hire tutors all summer long, pay a fortune just to get me through the exams. Like, she was just not letting me go down, you know, a different path. So there was a lot of conflict with that, as you can imagine, you know.
I think that's familiar to a lot of people.
I think so,
She really wanted you to go to Trinity.
She did, yeah. So when I finished my degree, I said, right, that's great, Mom, I've done all that now. Can I go out and start working? And even previous to that, I said, I don't want to go to college. I just want to work in a shop. And she's like, absolutely not. You know, you're not doing that. You're going to college. And after the degree, she goes, right, now you're going to do your postgrad in Trinity. And I said, what? I said, I'm done. I said, I can't keep going to school till I'm 90. Like,
that's how long was your degree? And you did that
4 years. ITT Tala. And it was a new degree at the time because it was just after the recession. So it was very honed into financial services and investment analysis. So it was very, I didn't want to do boring accountant. Sorry to all the accountants out there. But I wanted to do something a bit more feisty into the stockbroking world, asset management, investment analysis. That's kind of where I thought I wanted to go.
But Mammy said, stall the ball, you're going back in.
Stall the ball, you're going back to do more exams. And I was like, oh, jeez, I don't know how I'm going to get out of this. So it's not, obviously, you know, you get into Trinity, you have to apply, you have to write in, you have to be accepted. And I didn't pass my tax exam, right? So I had to repeat it at the end of the summer. And one of the, when she brought me in to Trinity, she brought me right up to the dean's door, knocked in and said, this is my daughter, this is our story, she must come here. Like, she just had Trinity, like, Trinity was it in her mind, you know. I was going to go anywhere after that. And she was like, and we told our story, we did the eyes, you know, we're here, like, you know. And I look at her and I look at me, I'm like, I see where I got it from, you know, because she was able to sell ourselves. Yeah, and
extraordinary things.
So he said, he was a very kind man, and he said, look, yeah, he goes, you're going to have to pass, you can't get in without,
no exceptions,
exactly, you're going to have to get an A in it, so over 90%. And I was like, how am I going to do that? So all summer long she hired a tax tutor to tutor me every single day for the whole summer.
Wow.
And come the end of the summer, I got 98% on my tax exam.
That was a stressful exam.
Oh, you've no idea. Like, and you think I'd be good at it.
You didn't even want to go to Trinity.
I didn't even want to go. Oh, no, but it was a great school and I had a great year. And
you come through Trinity and then you're into various jobs, really good, well-paid jobs in the corporate sector.
Fabulous jobs. Came through Trinity. There was one role after the postgrad that was circulating, which was an equity analyst role for a big firm. And I got it out of loads of us that interviewed. There was a four-round interview. You had to present a stock and give your recommendation on it. Then you had to meet the CFO. Then you had to meet the team. It was just this really, really rigorous role because it was a very small team. It wasn't go into one of the big four and be lost with 500 people. It was you and a portfolio manager. So it was a very, very intense mentoring role, amazing role. I got it and my mom was so proud. And yeah, I worked there for 3 years and really enjoyed it. But there was just something missing that I wasn't happy with the job. I love the aspects of learning about a brand and learning about a company and all the salesy bits and going to analyst days and stuff like that. But when it came to modeling and Excel for 3 days straight, just I wanted to hit my head against the wall, like, you know, just it wasn't me. So then I was trying to figure out, like, where can I go? I'm so pigeonholed here with all the academics behind me and the role. And I went into more of a stockbroking role then because I thought it'd be more salesy.
Yeah.
So then it was more exams.
Love the punishment of exam material.
Yeah.
And so you do all of that. But where does the motoring come in? We're all here and wondering, why are we hearing this amazing stockbroking story from Nadia Dan? She's selling cars in her own showroom now.
Exactly. So the stockbroking actually came from in work, believe it or not. I was surrounded by all these big traders. They were on serious money. It was me, 18 guys, and the head of our whole team, which was a female. She was very feisty. And I got my first loan. I got my first car. I ended up selling it myself on my lunch break. I made a few quid, or a twist, as we say in the motor trade.
Oh, right.
A twist, yeah. Okay. And I loved it. I did a few more times. I got to enjoy a car, drive it.
Was it kind of accidental, flipping the first car?
It was accidental. I put it up online on Dundeal and I sold it and I made a few quid. And
enjoyed the thrill of it.
I just enjoyed the people and chatting and getting, you know, and it's very like equities, you know, you buy low and you sell high. Yes, there's all these things that determine pricing, but you figure that out later.
Totally lost in the stockbroking speak, but yeah, I think I understand.
Oh, you do, come on. You're a lot more clever than that.
Didn't get 98% in any tax exam. the flipping, I can see the thrill of it. We can hear from your kind of effervescence, very bubbly personality, that this is, you're a people person. You want to be out chatting people, not staring at an Excel. that's the fun of the world. But it's quite a step, isn't it, to leave that job with all the promises of the riches that are dangled at you and to go out on your own is what you essentially do.
Absolutely. Like, you're going from a 9 to 5 and a guaranteed paycheck at the end of the month to kind of saying to yourself, I'm going to give it all my go. But my reasoning was, I built myself up that if it didn't work, I could walk straight back into any job I wanted. And, you know, and I also built it up to a point where I had a few quid saved up that if I did have a bad month, I would be able to cover myself. And it was a risk, Oliver, it was. But look, it's a risk that paid off, I suppose, in some ways. And just before the pandemic, I decided to quit my job, take a lease out on a yard in Rathnew. And I had a couple of cars when I started going. They're cheap cars. I didn't start off selling Lamborghinis and Bentleys. It was, you know, a Micra, Toyota, you know, that
you
type of stuff.
You wanted to get a movement through the showroom, essentially.
Absolutely. I just wanted to get turnover.
And it works well, even despite the pandemic years, you emerge from that.
Yeah. So again, the pandemic was kind of the moment where everything, I suppose, kind of came to a catalyst, because everybody was at home on their phones and everybody was on social media. So I started doing videos of my cars, of myself, and marketing myself and my cars on social media.
And it was particularly because of the location, was sort of off the road a little bit.
I wasn't on, like, I was in an industrial estate. There was no footfall. So and it was the pandemic. And people were like, who is this person selling cars in Wicklow? So I just had to find a way for people to know me, to get to know me, to trust me and to trust the brand and to grow.
And it worked spectacularly well.
It worked, absolutely, it worked amazing. So I suppose, just going back a little bit, I started just doing small videos, and then one day I did a viral video of myself. It's a bit of a, you know, some of your drivers might know my Any Guesses videos, maybe especially particularly if they're in the car at the moment, they might know. And so basically it's me at the back of a car revving it, and I'm kind of in a low cut top, bit sexy, and that went completely viral. It got millions of views, and not only that, it sold the car in the video. And when that happened,
sold the car.
It was an 80 grand oration. This is when I built up the profile a little bit and built up the quality stock. And when I sold the car, from a TikTok video, it was an 8 second video. I was like, hang on a second, there's something here. The video's going viral because there was a bit of controversy on it, that
people start commenting,
what are you doing? You're bringing women back, all this type of thing. But we all forget that manufacturers did this for years. They put women, you know, advertising in nice clothes with cars. Yeah. Now it's a woman doing it for herself, you know.
For your own business.
It's very different. And I always look at it as like a brand, a beauty brand. You see tanning brands, they're in bikinis, they're looking well. Why is it so different when a woman does it to a car and she's, you know, boosting herself and boosting the car?
What does your mammy think?
Oh, Jesus. She's gone back.
Straight back to Mogadishu.
She's gone straight back to Mogadishu.
So push back at home.
After bringing me to Trinity, to have to go and sell cars on the side of the road.
She can't deny the bottom line is...
Look, there's stress. There was always stresses at the beginning and, you know, sleepless nights. And I bought some big, big cars that, you know, not any brand can sell, on the hopes of that it would go viral and, you know, and push on. So there was a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. But it in the end of it, I kind of kept a level of professionalism where I was working on the business and doing everything right, which took years, but then marketing the way I wanted to market to get the views. Mm-hmm. So people couldn't say anything about the business. They could say some stuff about me, but it was 95% positive, but there was always that little 5%.
It doesn't sound like you're fazed by that 5%. You don't.
I was at the beginning, you know, I definitely was. I was kind of questioning my sanity. Am I doing this right? But then I think in anything in life, if you get pushback and you push through it and you know you're selling a good product, like, you don't have to be a mechanic to sell a car. You need to sell a good product. You need to have a good aftercare service and present your car well, and have that trust. And the social media really gives me that connection with my customers.
Of course,
and the leads that have been coming in through social media. My business is literally built now because of social media. I've been able to buy a premises on the motorway because of social media and the marketing that's given me.
I presume women are very comfortable coming to buy from you as well.
Absolutely. I have a great female clientele. Now, obviously, my audience is more men, and more men do buy cars. That's just stats.
Yeah.
However, the women portion is growing. We're probably seeing, I'm seeing about 20% women, 80% men.
Good.
And then in the 80%, it's men couples, men and women, coming in to buy a family car or whatever. But with the women, what I'm seeing is more women now are more independent. They're living on their own. They're buying their own houses. So I'd have the likes of CFOs, business owners that just ring me, Nadia, I'm ready to change. This is my budget. They don't want the spiel. They don't want the bullshit. They just want the, you know, talk straight, and they want a good deal.
If a man or a woman are coming in for a bit of flash,
yes,
are they? Is there a difference between the type of flash that a woman wants compared to a man?
Not really. A lot of women love Mercedes, I find. They love coming in for a good Merc or convertible. Yeah. Lately as well, the last couple of years, Range Rover has been very popular.
Among women?
If you're especially if you're living in Fox Rock, you drive a Range Rover. And if you're going to collect the kids, you're in your Volvo.
Spectacular. Russell Carroll.
Listen, you get to know a lot. You know, a lot about people with cars. Big giant Volvos coming at you.
Never out of the city.
It's only because their best branding was, oh, we keep kids safe, right? So,
yeah, like, but it is the ultimate kind of safe car.
That is the ultimate safe car. They are a good car, to be fair. But yeah, Range Rovers
are
a new thing.
There are cheaper priced safe cars too.
Absolutely.
It's a trophy car, isn't it?
But correct.
Who are we to judge?
I don't judge. I'm happy. I'll sell you a 10 grand car or a 100 grand car. It doesn't matter to me.
Will you get a bigger markup, I presume, on the more flashy?
Yes, you do. Absolutely. Yeah, you have to. The twist has to be bigger on the bigger cars for a couple of reasons. One, they sit on your forecourt longer. So like any investment, the longer it sits, the more you need back, because you might have to change pricing. You might have to reduce your prices. Market could change. And two, if an engine goes on a more expensive car, it's more expensive to fix. Now, usually it doesn't. But you still need a little bit more because it's such a big investment.
Someone straight in there, Range Rovers, aka the Fox Rock tractors.
They
get a lot of stick. They don't care.
Do you know what? Land Rovers get a lot of stick, but it's like anything. You know, if you get a nice Land Rover, right, that's lived its life in Fox Rock, that's been minded and been serviced before it's telling you it needs a service, then generally you're okay.
You're really into servicing cars, and you'll be looking after it before it tells you.
Yeah, after sales. Well, yeah, as in like you kind of go, look, you know, people generally go, ah, sure, I'll service it when it starts, the light comes on, and then I'll wait another month. I'll wait another month.
Yeah.
Do you know, whereas, you know, if you kind of know, look, every 7 to 10,000 kilometres and keep an eye on it. Mind it, it's not cheap. It's like a nice pair of heels. They're not cheap. They're not comfortable. Analogy, but yeah, they look good.
Do you service the heels as well?
I do, yeah.
But it is really important, because when we're buying a car, we want to know the service history, but then we're not thinking about flipping our own car at some point. Do you have to? You do have tips, don't you? Because SIMI, is that the motor industry?
SIMI, the society. SIMI. Yeah, it's the motoring body.
To get into it, it's quite, you're in there, aren't you?
I am in there,
approved dealers.
I'm approved dealer, yeah. I've got the big stamp, yeah, it's great.
And you go through a few hoops to get into it.
You do, initially, yeah, they check you out. They just make sure you've got all the proper insurance and your books are right. You've got a great garage code, everything. You know, you're a good business, Google reviews, everything. You know, so they...
So look for that sign if you're buying from a dealer. People buy privately quite happily all the time too.
They do. But as I always say, you know, buyers beware as well. Like, you might be saving a couple of grand, but if you are going to go buy privately, my advice would be do a history check. It costs a tenner. You know, sometimes people come out to me and, you know, we provide history checks, but they would have traded a car in and it could have been crashed or stolen. I'm like, did you do a history check when you bought it? And, oh, no, I didn't. And they paid 20 grand for it, where it's only a tenner you have to spend.
Just 10. That's your hot tip.
That's your hot tip.
We're going to finish on this one. Someone says your autobiography, which clearly you're going to do at some point. That should be titled From Fur Coat to Fur House.
That wins the day.
It does, yes. Nadia Dan, it's been great crack. Thanks for coming in for the chat. Ashford
Motors on TikTok, Instagram,
everywhere. Yeah.